I think that Christians should care about the issue of trauma because most people we know would have experienced it on some level, and most of us have ourselves too. So it's something that relates to everybody we probably know and to ourselves. It's just we might not have recognized what trauma is and its consequences for us. I got interested in understanding trauma more deeply when I was a nurse working in hospitals in the emergency department. And I would see pretty ordinary people come in, but the big factor was something horrendous had happened. So mum and the daughters might be there because dad was in an industrial accident. So here you have entirely common people, but they've experienced something horrific and they had to deal with it with the resources they had as a normal person. And I was a relatively normal person myself and a Christian, and I thought, geez, how do we handle horrific events and their aftermath? So that's how I got into thinking about trauma, which is experience of overwhelming fear that you're going to lose your life. And its consequences, because I was a nurse in a hospital and I was a Christian and I wanted to understand it properly. My name is Scott Harrower. I teach theology and history at Ridley College in Melbourne, Australia. And I write on the topic of trauma, and my big interest is how God helps us to recover from the experiences of trauma and how we can live after trauma, with a sense of safety, with a sense of ourselves, and connecting to the community.
I think a lot of people, when they hear that you were a nurse, I didn't know that you were a nurse, by the way. I feel like I've gotten to know you more and more, and I find out more and more every time I talk to you. But I think most Christians, if they're being dutiful, they would have heard that story about traumatized people who have experienced something, not the direct horror of an industrialized accident, for instance, but they've experienced the trauma of that happening to someone they love. Mm. Well, then the answer would be you just pray for them. So is there anything more than praying for somebody who's been in trauma? How should Christians process what to do in those moments?
So what medical and psychological science tell us is that if somebody experiences trauma, so the overwhelming threat to their sense of safety, that often what's going to happen is the moment of being threatened causes so much fear and is such an unusual experience that their brain can't process it properly. So if you're a soldier under fire, for example, it's such an unusual experience for a human being. It's such an unnatural thing that your brain, as it's wired up naturally, can't handle that sort of experience. So it means that people who've undergone over these overwhelming and scary experiences will keep on reliving them, because that's basically your brain saying, I've had this really bizarre experience. I just can't make it fit into my ordinary assumptions about the world. So that's why you have flashbacks. That way you'll have a sense of fear. You'll anticipate that event happening again, because your whole sense of who you are, how the universe works, has been messed up. So if we know somebody, for example, someone who has experienced a sexual assault or were assaulted with violence in a car park or something like that, or been in a horrific disaster, they won't just experience the event at the time and then it sort of works its way out of their system. What Christians need to do is to understand that psychological science tells us that for that person, what needs to happen for recovery is that they recover a sense of safety, a sense of themselves, and a sense of community, and it's going to take time. And part of the process is going to involve the person, the survivor, learning how to cope with these memories that keep on coming back. There may also be issues to do with energy. They might have really flat energy because they're spending all of their life trying to just handle being awake and keeping it together in everyday situations. So there's a lot that our friends, family, and fellow Christians can do to get around trauma survivors in order to encourage a recovery of safety, self, and community.
That's really helpful. I wonder also just the you know, the practical implications of people around us. I think as a former PTSD sufferer and someone who's seen it in other people, I think we often get confounded by people's behavior, right? So we're confronted with something that just doesn't make any sense to us, why they're acting this way. And so I think we're slow to help because we don't even connect it to something else that's happened. And then of course, children, women and children, I think are by far the largest group of people who suffer from PTSD or have been sexually traumatized. And so they don't even associate it. And so we're dealing with people who can't actually diagnose what's going on. So they don't know what to do. And all we see is this bizarre behavior that makes no sense to us.
Yeah, that's right. So the church is full of unusual and odd behaviors by all of us. However, a person who's been through a traumatic event or who suddenly has a family member who's been traumatized, they will act in ways that often have to do with how we attach to other people that are unusual. So let me explain. What often happens in trauma is that we lose our sense of establishing secure attachments to other people. So, Drew, we've known each other for a few years. We've been very comfortable having dinners and drinks together and conferences and stuff. Like, we're pretty comfortable around each other. So there's a sense of like trustworthiness and safety in that relationship. But should I experience a traumatic event between now and the next time we meet, perhaps you'll find me evasive because I really don't want to connect with you too much because I'm just not too sure. And that's because I may have been violently assaulted by someone I trusted. So I'm not really going to go about trusting you or pretty much anyone else in the same way I used to before. But because of a sense of shame about being beaten up and that I couldn't defend myself at the time, I'm probably not going to tell you what happened, right? You know, I'm a sort of someone who shouldn't be beaten up. That's how I understand myself. And
people, you know, should note that you're a pretty muscular guy.
Right. And you know, you're like a military guy and as friendly as you are, you know, I don't want you to look down on me. So I'm not going to tell you what's happened. But you will notice that I'm behaving differently. I won't be as warm, perhaps. I'll be a bit evasive. And I won't spend as much time with you and I won't disclose. Now, we will see all kinds of behavior to do with avoiding attachments in trauma survivors. So you might find them in your small group. They might come for a couple of sessions, disappear, and won't come back. They're not the kind of person who will regularly fit into Bible study patterns until they feel safe, until they feel that the group is a place where they can not only be safe, but that they can actually have boundaries. So, for example, if somebody who's been through a terribly traumatizing time shows up at a Bible study group and suddenly gets pounded with invasive questions and also requests to spend their time on various church rosters, they're not going to feel like they're able to maintain strong boundaries with everybody else. So they're going to push back and probably push off your group. So we will find all sorts of behaviors to do with attachment in trauma survivors that we may misunderstand as a lack of predictability, a lack of commitment to the group, a lack of serving in the church, a lack of empathy and engagement with others. Even worse, we might think that, you know, these people are acting in an unvirtuous manner. They're not long-suffering. They're not patient. They're not, you know, thoughtful and kind and so forth. So you can actually end up demonizing the trauma survivor who is trying to engage with other Christians very slowly by coming along to your prayer group, sussing it out. Okay, maybe that's not for me. And then they'll move on to another group and see, you know, if that's a good group. But each leader of those groups, if they're not talking to each other, will think that the person's erratic and untrustworthy. And that's a very poor way to go. So I think that there's a real need for the church to embrace what Paul does in 2 Corinthians, where Paul is very aware of the traumas that he has suffered. He talks about being afflicted and perplexed. He talks about the great trials he had, but he also recognizes that God sends along a great friend to comfort him. And Paul also recognizes that he needs the Christian churches around the Mediterranean as places of rest, recovery, and encouragement. And at the same time, Paul is someone who receives God's comfort so he can comfort others. So what we need to recognize in the church is that the experience of being perplexed and afflicted and troubled and traumatized is pretty much a universal condition. And God's call on us is, as far as we can, with the help, of course, of medical professionals and so forth, is to try to build one another up again in the church so that the body might be built to maturity and to health, so that we're acting out of the Spirit's work in us rather than negative coping behaviors or unfounded suspicions of other people because we don't understand our trauma and its dynamics very well.
I want to come back to that situation that you've outlined. I think it's a great one for us to think about as a test here. But since you introduced Paul, my next question was going to be about where in scriptures do we turn? So maybe I can ask you a more difficult question because Paul is very overt on this topic. Mm-hmm. Where would Paul have turned in his scriptures to discuss that trauma is real, that God cares about it, that maybe even where he could show solidarity with groups of people who've experienced trauma?
Sure. I mean, I think Paul would have been very familiar with the Psalms. And I think what the Psalms are, in a sense, and how I think about them is that they're the vocal cords of God where the Holy Spirit speaks to us through a many-stringed instrument or through his vocal cords. And he picks up the language of trauma and despair that we find from, you know, Psalm 3 onwards, which is pleading with God to give ear to our cries, to listen to our sighing. So Psalm 5 talks about, listen to the sound of my cry, hear my voice. And there's an assurance in the Psalms that God is the one who doesn't delight in wickedness or evil, yet we experience it, and so therefore the psalmist continue to call on God to act. So I think Paul would be someone who would understand the Psalms as the language to call out to God and then also expect from God a response to restore righteousness and to be faithful in terms of his character, which is what we find in the book of Job. So I think Paul would have been very familiar with those kind of stories where the individual calls out to God, but Paul would have also been very comfortable with the corporate aspects of disaster, thinking back on Israel's oppression under Egypt and then the disastrous events to do with exile, lamentations, and then even the return to the land is pretty miserable. So Paul would have known about the corporate aspects of trauma and oppression and being kicked in the teeth and people saying, where is your God now? Look at you, you're nothing.
Yeah, I recently interviewed a friend, Jim Diamond, who's a Jewish theologian, philosopher. Technically, they don't like to think of themselves as theologians, but I think he would. And, you know, one of the things that struck me, he's become a friend over the years, is when he discusses very casually the fact that his parents were Holocaust survivors.
Right.
Every aunt and uncle was a Holocaust survivor. Everybody that he grew up in his neighborhood was a Holocaust survivor. And that essentially he was raised by a community of trauma.
Yeah.
And how much that has sculpted and shaped Jewish thought in the 20th century. So much so that he says, you know, you can't be a Jewish thinker and not deal with the Holocaust. And so I think, you know, the Jewish community actually offers us a living community of people who have experienced these traumas. And we can actually think about how they use the Psalms and how they use these texts as well. You know, I'm not saying that all of it is great use of it, right? Where there's humans, sometimes we misappropriate or we go down the wrong path. But I think that corporate idea of trauma, and I think if we're in communities where there are veterans or if you're working in a, I think it's, in America, it's great for churches to go down and volunteer in a homeless shelter, right, or something like
this. Okay, right, okay.
But But I think it's, I think Americans, this is my guess, is that American evangelicals are often going to think about individual people who are down on their luck, having a hard time, maybe at best having a little bit of a mental health crisis that led to this issue. And it's difficult for us to conceive of entire communities of trauma and or how to dig in, because now it's not just me praying for somebody. It's not just me trying to help somebody out or be an understanding. It's a corporate systemic. It's spiraling out of control if you don't help in certain ways. And so I think there's a lot of need for discussion in the church about how do we help with communities or groups of people that are typically traumatized.
Yeah, and I think one of the main insights that we receive in the New Testament, but also in the Hebrew Bible, is that God is very concerned about those who are traumatized, both individuals and communities, and God works through other people to bring consolation to those who have suffered. I think one of my concerns is that we often look for God to give us an immediate, invisible, direct solution to heal us from our trauma and the kind of the storm of recovery and life after the storm. But what we see in the Bible is God puts his concerns into the heart of Titus, for example, so that Titus might encourage Paul. God puts his concerns for the Jerusalem Christians into the hearts of the Macedonian Christians so that they raise a collection that they send through Paul and others down to Jerusalem. That God has the care for individuals and communities, and he will minister to them, but he will do it indirectly through people who are open to himself and who are open to him shaping us and growing us through the Spirit so that we might be righteous, be people of peace and people of joy. As it says in Romans, the kingdom of God is righteousness, peace, joy in the Spirit. So I think that that's one of the key insights for us, because we often feel paralyzed when it comes to helping people who've been through horrendous situations. But the big reminder is, in the New Testament in particular, and also in the Hebrew Bible, is that God is going to work. He's still active. He will do so by working through his people. So we need to pay attention to one another rather than look up to the sky for immediate solutions.
Yeah, I think that's so important that we... When I think of the word spirituality or disciplines of the Spirit, of course, there are individual disciplines of the Spirit that we need to practice regularly. But everything you described about the church itself coming around people who are traumatized, people who have been traumatized and have been healed over time, that they actually can be some of the best people to interact with the traumatized, and that that itself is a spiritual activity. Go ahead. I'll let you talk about that.
Well, for example, when we look at the Beatitudes, and I'm in Matthew 5 now, I think Jesus is describing precisely the kind of person or the qualities of a people group that I would wish would surround survivors, whether they be individuals or communities. In Matthew 3, Jesus says, "Blessed are the poor in spirit, for theirs is the kingdom of heaven." I would like someone who's poor in spirit, who's humble, who seeks after God, to be the one who comes around us. Someone who mourns over the evils in the world. Someone who is meek, who is gentle, who's not going to use you, who's not going to walk all over you. Someone who hungers and thirsts for righteousness. Someone who understands that what happens in trauma is wrong. It goes against human flourishing. It diminishes who we are as God's images made for creative, moral relationships, and therefore, because they're hungering and thirsting for righteousness, they want to do something about it and help. We've just seen the Black Lives Matter marches. That's a great example of hungering and thirsting for righteousness and doing something about it. God also wants to shape us, verse 7, to be merciful, to be, in verse 8, pure of heart. We need safe people to come around survivors. And we also want people who are peacemakers, people who can move towards reconciliation and the restoration of shalom. These are the ones that Jesus calls to surround one another, people that are even willing to be persecuted for righteousness' sake. So people who are courageous, who've got guts, who love, who work in faith, but also in hope, hoping for a different kind of world. And they're the kind of people we want to be around survivors, and in time, survivors may be shaped into those very kinds of people themselves, and they regain a sense of agency, of boundaries, safety in the world. I think what the Christian faith offers us is a vision for recovery from trauma, whereby we might become channels of God's care for other people. So I think the Bible's got a lot to say about trauma itself, recovery, how we can participate in God's kingdom for his good. And for many of us, the good works to which God has called us, as it says in Ephesians, are actually coming alongside as godly people and communities and walking with others in the journey of restoration. And it happens in the midst of everyday life.
That's so good. And as someone, my church, we're in Newark, New Jersey, and we've kind of dedicated to befriending a community housing project and the children there. And I think one of the things that I've realized over the last almost 10 years now of working in that community, and my children spend time in that community, is that it's not going to be easy, especially when you have entire communities that have suffered traumas. It really is. You got to stick in. And the issue of trust, we have realized, you know, where you spend 5 years kind of working away 2-3 times a week, doing the things you need to do to build trust. And it takes, you know, 5-6 years before that first bit of trust breakthrough happens. Yeah. And if the people of God are not dedicated to that, you know, if it's 2-3 years and they don't really see any fruits, as we like to call them, you know, it's really easy to back out of those situations. And it so sure there's, and who is making 10-20 year commitments to hurting communities these days, right?
Right.
It's a different paradigm for ministry, as they say.
Yeah, it sure is. You're right about that. And the great thing is that God gives us concern for other people and gives us the gifts of long suffering and goodness and thoughtfulness. So it's with the Spirit that God can help us to become the kind of people that have the gentle and humble heart of Jesus and who don't buy into the kind of KPIs that the world tries to shove down our throat.
What are KPIs?
Key performance indicators. It's corporate speech that's invaded Christianity, and it's absolutely appalling. Yeah.
Well, I hope that our listeners haven't been distracted by your beautiful Australian accent, because I know the Americans will love it, and that they hear you're a systematic theologian. You actually do a style of what we call analytic theology.
That's right.
Yeah, your recent book, God of All Comfort, A Trinitarian Response to the Horrors of This World, is a serious, meaty piece of theology on the idea of trauma and horror and response. I think... But even if you're not an expert, you can read this and get some. I've actually recommended it to many lay people who have read it and really enjoyed it.
Thanks.
But I think, Scott, you are doing the exact type of theology we need in this world. And of course, I think we can all now hear how God has used, obviously, some traumas in your life and your life experience to pull forward. Thank you so much for taking this time. We're separated by, I don't know, 15 time zones or so.
Yeah,
but taking this time late at night to talk with us at the Center for Hebraic Thought. Anything you'd like to?
It's a pleasure. It's a pleasure. And I just want to commend the Center for Hebraic Thought, because I've started sharing it with our students, and they've found that there are great resources in Scripture that they hadn't realized were there to deal with commonplace issues they face. So thank you for directing it and helping the Christian community be even more deeply aware of the riches that God has for us in the Bible.
All right. Thank you, Scott.
No worries.
Thank you for listening to the Center for Hebraic Thought podcast. Be sure to subscribe, rate, or leave us a review wherever you found us. Want to learn more about Hebraic Thought? Visit our website at HebraicThought.org.